This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 458, Generative Podcast, Andy and Michael's version. Hello and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin. I am joined today by my friend and co-host Andy Piper while Michael Rowe is away on other adventures. Andy, how are you today?
Hi, Michael. I am well, thank you. I've just spent, I think this will come up in our show as we converse. I've been at an event in London for the last couple of days, and I'm currently recording from an unusual location in the sense that it's not one that I'm normally in for recording, but we're all good. I'm looking forward to seeing what we've got to talk about.
Oh, and we've got fun stuff, as we always do. So thanks again to our listeners and everyone suggesting what we might take on board. For those of you who don't know how to do that, have a look at our website, gamesatwork.biz, and you'll see lots of ways of connecting with us. And we're going to start off with kind of a fun article from New Scientist. It's not one that I think we read all the time or see all the time, but in the AI space, there is a thought experiment in this article about could an AI that is highly motivated to go out and look at all of the music files everywhere on the planet, replace them with Taylor Swift, Taylor's version covers? So I think they had like Paperback Writer as an example that could be done in Taylor Swift style. And Andy, you know, in the talk that I gave at the School of Science and Math now a couple of weeks ago, I did use the example of Johnny Cash singing Barbie Girl that we've talked about on the show before. So this kind of thing could happen. There could be a rogue AI, and it could go out and say, find every audio file and convert them because that's its objective. What do you think about that?
Well, today and yesterday, I've been at an event in London called Monkey Growl, which is run by our friends from Redmonk, which is an industry analyst firm. And they have, for many years, been running these craft-oriented tech events. And they came about partly because they jokingly said, what if we did a conference that was focused on the craft of software engineering and beer? And then somebody offered to sponsor such an event, and it became a thing. So they run one in the fall in Portland in Maine, where James Governor's partner, Stephen O'Grady, is based from Redmonk. And right, that one is called Monktoberfest. And they run one here in the spring called Monkey Grah. And it hasn't happened for 5 years. So first of all, it's been a pleasure to see people that I haven't seen for a while and they're part of the community. But the reason I started immediately talking about this before, because it sounds a bit of a non sequitur, is that this year's event was subtitled Prompting Craft. So it was focused on the AI wave and the way that Monkey Grah and Monktoberfest operate is that they encourage a sort of meta approach to thinking about the topic, and they curate the talks carefully to bring in some different perspectives, which is one of the reasons why I think the attendees very much enjoy them. And there are a number of talks that touch on things that I think we're going to talk about in the next 20 minutes or so, and this is one of them. Now, my immediate knee-jerk response to your question that you just asked me, what do I think about that, is this is ridiculous. What you just said is ridiculous, and the concept is ridiculous. And the concept of this New Scientist article is ridiculous in that the author or the people that came up with it admit it, right? They say, look, this is a thought experiment.
Exactly.
It's exceptionally unlikely to the point of, you know, not being possible, really, I think, that a rogue AI will delete all data all over the world and replace it with covers of Taylor Swift music for lots of reasons that are practical. But let's run with the thought experiment, right? So the idea here is that you would your AI would get hold of the song and the topic, and whether it's Paperback Writer by the Beatles or Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen or whatever, and replace it with a Taylor Swift-ified version of that song. And, you know, it's a ridiculous notion, but it has some interesting things in it. The reason I say it's ridiculous is because one of the talks today was by a fellow historian, a gentleman that studied history at Oxford exactly the same 3 years that I was there. And he was talking about the history of chess and the history of chess computers, going all the way back to the Mechanical Turk, which of course was not a computer. It was a clever bit of fakery, but coming all the way forward through our shared experience with Deep Blue and other things that have happened in both of our lifetimes, where a chess computer did beat a grandmaster, and then that grandmaster was very upset and then was forced to recant his accusations that he was cheated, to admit that actually, okay, he was beaten. But the point that the speaker Ian was making was that, you know, we might dismiss the notions, as I did last week with Michael Rowe, of AGI as not being possible, and these rogue AIs and things not being possible. But in actuality, given that it took 20 years for a chess computer to develop to a point where it could defeat a grandmaster, are we at the same point with other AI models right now? So I think it's interesting as a thought experiment. I don't think it's a real threat and a real thing. I've just been exposed to some interesting thinking in the last couple of days. And again, I think that they'll be talking about those in a bit further as we go through the next few links.
I'm so glad that you shared that. And I agree with you, it is ridiculous. But as thought experiments go, sometimes the ridiculous then springs new insight. And one of the things that's made me, this New Scientist article made me think about, was the notion of data and data integrity and how vast swaths of data could be corrupted, altered, and changed, right? We place a high stock on something being available, published, and from a trusted source. And that's not unique to an artificial intelligence, but you could see where scanning, discovering, finding, and altering on a massive scale, you know, is a possibility, right? As ridiculous as this particular thought experiment goes, that's one of the things that had me starting to think about, okay, well, there are repositories like the Library of Congress, for example, in the United States and others that arguably should be a trusted source of data, but are those trusted sources of data fully immune to potential tampering and alteration? And the answer is, well, no one's immune to anything. That's the whole cat and mouse story.
Right. I mean, we've talked in the not so distant past about the big hack that happened on the British Library last year, which they have recovered from, and it will take them many years potentially to recover from, because the nature of the incident destroyed many of their systems, and those systems were essentially used to enable them to locate the physical copies of the volumes. But those are physical copies, right? So the actual data is there, it's safe. It's just not findable because the way of their indexing system essentially has been destroyed or compromised. So it's very difficult now for you to go into the British Library and request a volume, and then for them to go off and find it in the stacks, some of which are many miles away from the venue and so on. So, you know, there is hard copy in that case. If there isn't hard copy, which is the case in many forms of recorded music, there isn't a copy of it other than in a digital file form somewhere, then technically, yes, it's possible that it could be invaded, corrupted by a rogue digital artificial intelligence. But again, I find the actual notion of it very remote. I've really thought to myself a lot harder today, in particular, having thought about this again yesterday in terms of AGI and thinking, don't be so silly. Confronted today with the idea, and very persuasively put by somebody who was at the same stage of life as me, that actually we may not be as far off as I've been dismissing, but we'll see.
Well, you know, that leads in really nicely, Andy, to the next article that we've got, which deals with the concept from Cognition Labs, who has created a capability that they're calling Devon AI. Mm. Another interesting thing here that we give names to these AIs, even though they're not really, you know, people or people like, but I guess that's part of the whole anthropomorphization of what we go.
Right.
And this one is a software engineering AI that is designed to be able to train other agents to then act together to create software. Mm-hmm. So it's the notion, and I've been liking this thought quite a bit as of late, of expressing, manifesting something into reality, you know, create a Pong game for me, which is kind of the example that they use here, to have an agent that is aware of other agents that can do things like, oh, I can design user experiences as an agent, or I can write a certain code as an agent, or I can interpret documents as an agent, and then cobble that together to come out with an outcome, right? So in this case, it is a software agent that is performing in the role of a software engineer, which then creates an output, which is software output that then can be used by people.
So let me, again, fall back immediately onto my most recent experience at MonkeyGraph 2024. Mm-hmm. And I think there were at least two, if not three, talks that spoke directly to this. So there's a couple of angles here. One of them is the fear replacement potential fear, right? So the idea that people should be worried because if they're a software engineer, then their job's going to go away because an AI will take it over. And there's a couple of elements to that. I think this is kind of fractal in terms of the different angles that you can take here and the dimensions and paths you can go down. But one of them is there was a lady who works for Google who gave a bit of a pitchy talk at the end, but it was referring to the capabilities that Google's Gemini model has around writing code. But she was very much pitching it as enabling the developers that work there to you know, be more productive more quickly because they know stuff. So there's that element. But the one that I found most interesting, and I think a lot of people did, was a talk yesterday by Dr. Kat Hicks from Developer Success Lab, which is part of Pluralsight. It's an open science lab there. And she's a psychological scientist who has done a ton of work and presented a ton of studies and data about how Gen AI coding tools such as Copilot, which this one Devin references as a semi-competitor, how it influences developer beliefs on their future. So she had this term of people's sensitivity to an AI skill threat. And in a study of 2,400 people, they found that 43% of those people showed a high level of that AI skill threat as developers. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just a fear of skill loss or skill replacement. It was also a fear of how other people view them. And there was a ton of information in the study around field-specific ability beliefs as well. So essentially how confident you might be in your field and in your capability within that field. So very interesting study results. But I think overall there was a big focus on using AI as a tool rather than having it replace us. There were elements of, look, you can even take a picture of a user interface sketch on a napkin now and the computer will build it for you. But again, that's fine, provided that the computer has access to all of the information that is required to build something that does the thing. Another angle that came up in today's sessions was the idea of using the AI tools as kind of a linguistic teacher. So you could think of using Duolingo, for example, to learn a language. This talk took the angle and approach of, what if I took a, let's say, well-managed or well-written standard library for a coding language, and then use Copilot to interrogate that, to highlight a function and say, explain to me what this does. And would your ability to talk through in an interview scenario what that function does match what Copilot's telling you it does? And then how closely do those things come together? How confident do you feel in describing code to your peers or somebody you're teaching or somebody you're interviewing? So that was a lot of information about things I heard about at Monkey Gras in the last 2 days. But I think that, again, we're seeing people trying to put generative AI to use as a tool and come up with some useful outputs. And there's no harm in that. For basics and by saying basics, it makes it sound like I'm belittling it. I'm not. I think it is a good boilerplate level set for people to get things done and potentially for coders, people who can't code, to describe what they want to happen. But I think there's still a lot of scope for us as either prompt engineers or as software developers here.
Well, I want to touch on that for a second before we move on, Andy. And as we've been doing the college and university hunt for my daughter, one of the things that has really appealed to me is the notion of the combination of the humanities writ large with technology. And we've talked about that before, places like Harvey Mudd out in California, others that put a big focus on humanities plus engineering being an important way to describe, to articulate, to highlight why backgrounds in history, English, literature, all kinds of other elements are crucial to success in the future. Did that come up in any of the talks as well?
Well, as I mentioned, one of those talks was by a fellow historian. And he'd taken ChatGPT and tried to get it to rewrite an essay from when he was at university, when he and I were at university. And, you know, it didn't do a very great job. But I mean, actually, there's a very strong element here of using different techniques and different areas of knowledge to inform our interactions with GPTs and LLMs. There's a whole, in fact, you remember that Gandalf getting Gandalf to tell you the password or thing?
Yes.
That came up in a talk today as well. And so there was a threat modeling thing. How can we think about how we
socially engineer our way into
exactly right? So, yeah. so there was a number of these kind of elements to the event. It did leave me with some anxiety in some areas because some people were really talking about using it in a way that I didn't find particularly helpful or useful, and increased my anxiety around gumming up the internet with junk or doing things that actually just annoy me. Versus creating useful outputs. But I did enjoy the focus on understanding what's going on. And I think there's a lot of that in taking a humanities approach, you know, whether that's English, history, politics, policy, you know, those kind of areas. I think there's a ton of angles that are useful to consider.
Yeah, I really think that's going to be important for people that are thinking about going into these opportunities and roles in the future. And this article does say things like, hey, you know what, learn to code is becoming less relevant. But I would argue too that you do need to understand, just like a mathematics professor needs to understand the basics and how to do the basics, that you can't just leap into the advanced stuff and not know how to do the basics.
And there were two other really good things. And we've talked a lot just on a couple of links here today, but there were a couple of other really good things. So the first talk today was by two mothers who were talking about stochastic parrots and basically prompting children. And they have children of a range of ages. And, you know, for example, saying the word hands to a 3-year-old might mean, right? I.e. go wash your hands, right? If you say hands to ChatGPT, it will say something like, it looks like you want to know something about hands, or, so there was an element of, you know, the questioning, the prompting. There was also in there, at what point does the LLM assume that you want action to be taken with an imperative type. Ah,
so of, the, of, there's hands and there's hands.
Yeah, right. And there's a whole range of things in there. And I have just forgotten the other thing I was going to bring up that it was also brilliant and fascinating. I'm just scrolling through my list of notes from. The other one was somebody who yesterday talked about learning to dance as a really good analog for learning to trust an AI, because they made the point that if you were to walk into a dance class with no experience, then the first thing that you're likely to be taught is literally a single step that would maybe move one foot from left to right and backwards and forwards, and have everybody in the room do that together to gain confidence. And then, you know, as you progress in your dancing, you need to know that the person you're dancing with, you need to understand their level of confidence and skill. So there was a ton of stuff and a fascinating thought process there about learning to trust the tool you're working with, learning to understand its skill level, learning to understand how comfortable you are with its responses to you. And there was a really information about a really, really strong element of your level of trust in the data that's coming back. So you start off with basic queries that you can verify the answers to, rather than you asking something super complicated that you have no chance of knowing whether the information you're getting back is valid or not. But you then, and if you then take that at face value and are disappointed because it's totally hallucinated, then why would you ever trust asking that same source again? If you build up your trust, then there's an entirely different relationship. So,
but that's a hackable thing too, isn't it?
Of course,
you know,
it is.
Isn't there the 20 questions that you can ask another human being that will cause you to fall in love with them? Right.
There's various traps that can be laid in this as well, but I found that a really interesting way of approaching the way that we think about how to interact with these tools.
Well, and the confidence element is also intriguing here too, because the one of the hallucination, you know, elements there is that the tool comes across with a confident answer and may even try to prove with here's this or that link that you can trust what I've given you, even though it was completely fabricated. Remember when you first asked, you know, who is this Andy Piper character anyway? And it came back with all of these very authoritative statements.
Yeah.
And then it apologized when you corrected it.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like, okay, but it came across confident, and confidence is crucial in all of this to build trust.
Absolutely.
Wow. So many cool things.
You've just had the same kind of, I think, series of brain sparks that I've had for the last few days. I could just see it as you were repeating, you're having that sensation there. It was interesting to watch.
Well, we're so lucky, you know, to have these opportunities to chat with one another. And there are so many other things we had on the list to talk about, but we're going to close off with an intriguing game around space. Let's save that New York Times article maybe for another time.
Well, but this just came across our radar just after we actually had Michael and I recorded last week's show. And I think it may have come through over the weekend while Michael was very kindly editing last week's show. And this is a game, a tabletop game that NASA has released. So the story is published on Polygon, but they've released a tabletop game about it's an RPG, which is designed to be played in a party with 4 to 7 players. And it gives you some basics. So some storyline, it gives you a map and so on. But the idea is that you, I think, then play it on top of your existing tabletop RPG system. I jokingly made the comment to you and Michael in our group chat that the three of us should play it as a live episode of the show, but we need another player. So we could probably, I think you suggested, Michael, we could have ChatGPT be our fourth player, for example. I love that they've kind of made it a lore around Hubble and NASA and various other things. I think it's a really nice way of engaging with a broader community around NASA and space and things there. I'm not entirely sure beyond that what the purpose of it is. I mean, other than sort of being interesting.
General engagement.
Yeah. Getting people excited about exploration. But it's definitely seemed like it was in our wheelhouse. Come on, it's board games, tabletop games, RPGs, space, tech, all of our
Tolkien-esque maps. I mean, come on, right?
All of our topics encapsulated in one story and one link.
Well, the one thing NASA's missing is they did not have a Lego partnership with this. So come on, NASA.
There's a lot of Lego space stuff this year, again, which is always a delight to see. But I will throw in one more link since we've got one moment left, which is a game that's available on for the Pico 8, which is a virtual fantasy console, which you can download for free. But it's a game called Puzzles of the Paladin. Is just a kind of a fun, it's really beautifully drawn given that it's such a limited little 8-bit style graphics. And you can play it in your browser as well, because the way that Pico 8 works is that the runtime can, because it's a virtual console, can run in your browser. But it's kind of a block pushy puzzle game that might be fun for folks to have a look at.
Love it. Well, team Andy, Michael, that's us now. A lovely chance to catch up and to talk, and hearing about all the Monkey Grass experiences was fantastic too. So looking forward to having Michael back with us again, mm-hmm. and we will continue these conversations right here on gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.